You have aligned to Wisconsin's champion spellers here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and prepare to be humbled. They're advancing to the Scripps National Spelling Bee. They're veterans, been there before. Preliminary rounds for the National Bee are set for June in a virtual format. Final rounds, take place in July in Orlando. Did you participate in a spelling bee? How did it go? What word tripped you up? 800-642-1234. Emmanuel Govias is an eighth grader at North Middle School in Menominee Falls. He won the co-champion title after 20 rounds in the Badger State Spelling Bee. This will be his third trip to nationals. Emmanuel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Maya Jadoff, who is a seventh grader at Eagle School in Fitchburg and co-champion of the Badger State Spelling Bee. This will be her third trip to nationals as well. Maya, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. And good morning to Brad Williams, who's been the pronouncer for the State Bee for more than 40 years and was a state champion himself way back when. Brad, welcome to you.
Way back when. Thank you very much.
We can just leave it at that, right? No. So as pronouncer, you speak the words out loud for the speller, but explain for us the full role of the pronouncer.
The pronouncer is the person with all of the words, which in our bees, the Badger Bee, are provided by the Scripps Company, which runs the National Spelling Bee. And they give us the words and anything else that the spellers want to know about those words. And Emmanuel and Maya can tell you they are in the habit of asking a lot of questions. The language of origin, or what part of speech it is, can you use it in a sentence, which I normally do. Also, are there other pronunciations that might give you a clue, and such as in the case of the language of origin, if it's French or it's Spanish at all, that could tell you how a word is spelled. So I have all that information, and the judges are also there to tell us if the word is spelled correctly. And we're there to help the spellers to make sure that they know exactly what we're going for and to steer them in the direction. And in many cases, they don't need that much help from us because they've studied very intensely.
Well, it sounds like you have to do a bit of studying yourself on these words and pronounce them correctly.
You do have to go over the list. They give us the list ahead of time, a few weeks, and so we check the pronunciations and see how they are used if we're not familiar with them. And in many cases, the average person watching a spelling bee might not know all the words that the spellers can sometimes seemingly just say, just like that. We know it.
Well, Maya, how have you prepared for these bees, and how do you go into a bee? What is your frame of mind?
I just try to stay calm, and when I go into a bee, I know that I can't do any more studying. I've already done my best while studying, so I just try to be calm and remember what I've practiced before.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for us or how to shake off nerves or those butterflies in the stomach? How do you keep your cool?
Well, if you have like butterflies in your stomach, you could like drink water or maybe think about other things when it's not your turn.
Okay. Emmanuel, how do you prepare for spelling bees and especially going into the national competition?
Yeah. So first of all, there's a list that is given to us by the Scripps Company, and I first try to make that as thorough as I can, and after that I try to look at some, like, learn some word roots and also rules of specific language of origins.
So those lists that come from Scripps, is that the words of the champions, that 4,000 word list?
Yeah, that's correct.
Oh my goodness. How do you go about studying 4,000 words?
Well, I always try to do the whole thing just a few times and then take the words that are the most challenging to me and then just keep doing those over again.
So a lot of repetition. Is that helpful to repeat?
Yeah, for me, if it's in my, like, head, if I do repetition, it'll get in my head, so.
Yeah. We're talking with Emmanuel Govias and Maya Jadoff, who are both co-champions of the Badger State Spelling Bee qualifying for the Scripps National Spelling Bee. Brad Williams is here as well, the pronouncer for the Badger State Spelling Bee. You can join in. Have you been part of a bee? Maybe you are a parent of a spelling bee participant. How did they get involved? How do you help prepare them for competition? 800-642-1234. So Brad, what do you see out of the competition? What was the competition like this year in a pandemic year?
In a pandemic year, we had to make some adjustments. The Badger Bee organizers, also the CESAs, around the state, because I pronounced the CESA for the La Crosse area as well, that we had to go virtual. We had the spellers generally either at their homes or at their schools and joining us online. And so we could see everybody at once and had to make sure that they muted their microphones when they weren't spelling so we didn't get any distracting background noise. And it was not the same kind of drama and perhaps tension that you would get if they're all sitting next to each other on a stage, but it was still dramatic as well. And by this time next year, maybe we'll be back to having everybody on a stage, but adapting it this way was a little challenging and interesting as well.
Oh, I just love that atmosphere and that drama of walking up behind the microphone. You know, take us back to 1969 when you were 12 years old. How did it feel for you to participate in the state spelling bee?
It was something that didn't surprise me. I had been winning the classroom spelling bees for a few years, and I had just a couple of years of participation at the B level, which leads up to the Badger B and also the National B. And I wasn't that worried, and I perhaps did not spend nearly as much time studying as the spellers do today, because they've seen the B nationally and they may have seen movies about spelling bees. And I just myself took it for granted that I knew the words. I wasn't terribly concerned. Maybe I should have been a little more. I did get to the fourth round in the Nationals, and in those days they only had 73 spellers from around the country competing. It is much more popular than that today. They have hundreds. I think the last Live Bee in 2019 was 700 or 800 students, and many of them could also qualify through a program that if you didn't win your local B, you could still qualify saying, well, I've done this and that, and they would send you to Washington too, or this year to Orlando. But it was a very fascinating thing to do. I love the B. I have actually been able to go back to Washington a couple of times as a spectator and see how that goes now, and it is a really good time.
Oh, Maya, what does it feel like to go to Washington and, you know, be part of that spectacle of the National Bee?
It's really exciting, and it's so exciting to meet all the different spellers and just have the experience on the stage. It doesn't matter like how I do at that point. It's just the experience is so good. And I'm a little disappointed that it's only going to be the top 10 in person this year. But it's still going to be fun.
Oh, top 10 in person in Orlando at Disney, I understand. Emmanuel, what is it like for you to go to Washington and be part of that national spectacle with all of those students from around the country?
Yeah, it's a really good experience. Going there is always, really fun, to be around so many other talented spellers. And spelling on the national stage is also a really good experience.
Well, you know, just for the mood here, we're going to try out a word. And this is open to everyone, our callers as well. The word is sheathed. It's a verb that means to cover with something that protects. An example of sheathed used in a sentence is Sometimes shipbuilders sheathe a ship's bottom with copper for extra protection from barnacles and other threats. How do you spell sheathed? And we'll get to that. Emmanuel Govias and Maya Jadoff are co-champions of the Badger State Spelling Bee. Brad Williams, the Bee's pronouncer. You can join in on sheathed or anything else on spelling bees. Are you a parent? How did you get involved? What do you do to prepare? Do you make an event out of watching the scripts be on ESPN like we do at our house? Oh my gosh. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Champion Spellers here on the Ideas Network. We've rounded up Wisconsin's champion spellers, and we're learning what makes them tick here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How many hours does a student have to study words to do well at the National Spelling Bee? The Words of the Champions, as we've been talking about, is the official study resource with 4,000 words. Have you studied the list? What are your memories of spelling bees? 800-642-1234. We have 7th grader Maya Jadoff of Eagle School in Fitchburg and 8th grader Emmanuel Govias from North Middle School in Menominee Falls. They're co-champions qualifying for the National Bee. And pronouncer of the Badger State Spelling Bee, Brad Williams, stays with us. Mark is joining us from Wauwatosa and wants to take a stab at sheathed. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, S-H-E-A-T-H.
Uh-huh. Can you keep going?
That's it.
Sheathed. See, Brad, how do you make sure you can hear every single syllable? What am I doing wrong?
I thought you did well. We just had to emphasize
that this was a past tense.
Oh.
Especially the way you said it in the sentence was fine, but, okay. But it is a past tense in this case.
How does that help you out, Mark? Past tense.
Okay, I'll try S-H-E-A-T-H-E-D.
There we go. Brad, I've got some serious work to do here. Mark.
Well, keep going at it.
Mark, what do you think of spelling bees?
Oh, I used to love them in elementary school. I remember my friend Danny Smith would beat me in the spelling bee, and I'd be so disappointed. But
oh, dear. Emmanuel, what do you do with friends? Do they help you out? Are they your teammates, or does this get really competitive?
No, a lot of the time they're actually just there to support me and congratulate me.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Maya? Is it hard to have friends who are also trying to do the same thing?
Not really. Like Emmanuel said, it's mostly they just encourage me and support me. Yeah.
Maya, how do you feel about a word you've missed? What goes through your head?
Well, I guess there's nothing I can do about that word now, but I'll remember it forever if I got it wrong before.
Yeah, yeah. What about you, Emmanuel? How do you talk through that afterward feeling when you've missed that last word, you've missed a word?
Yeah, I mean, when you've just gotten a word you don't know, I mean, oftentimes you just will feel like a little unlucky that you got that word. But yeah, like Maya said, it's something you won't really forget.
You don't forget. Does it get easier spelling? Does it ever get easier, Emmanuel?
I think the more words you like study and see, and the more work you put in each day, the more words you end up covering. Yeah, I think there's a chance you will have seen a word you get. You will have seen it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maya, do you organize words into lists or any type of lists when you're studying?
Yeah, usually I have like a big list, which I do a couple times. And then like once I've identified which ones I don't know, I just practice that list again. And usually it's just a bunch of revision lists that I keep going on.
Yeah. So Brad, you know, oftentimes in the movies, you know, one of our perennial favorites at home is Aquila and the Bee. We love that movie, but Do these kids have spelling coaches in the real world? Are there coaches who do this?
There are definitely spelling coaches. Around the time I was in the B, one of the national winners, I think the next year, had a coach who had been helping her out for 3 years. So that I think was considered a bit rare back in those days. It's probably a lot more common now, because I know that there are people in Wisconsin who perform as coaches and are able to help some of the spellers who get into the Badger program.
Yeah. Maya, what about a coach for you? Do you have one?
Yeah, I do have a coach. And while I'm on here, I just wanted to say thank you to my coach.
Aww.
And also thank you to my dad for preparing all of my work lists.
Oh, I love that. Emmanuel, who would you like to thank?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would thank my family for always supporting me and helping me with words. And then all my teachers throughout the years, and also my principals, especially the learning specialists in my school district, which is Mrs. Lee and Mrs. Wolf. They've also helped me a lot throughout the years.
Oh, that's wonderful. May I ask, do you have a coach?
I wouldn't say necessarily I have a coach. A lot of the credit goes to my parents, because my dad usually creates a study plan so I can stay organized and on task with what I'm doing. And my mom is usually the one who quizzes me on the words that I do.
Yeah, it sounds like you have to be really organized to do this, and, you know, pretty determined and disciplined.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you ever want to not, I mean, do you ever have to coax yourself into studying, or, you know, try to get yourself to do it and, you know, put a little carrot in front of yourself, give yourself a little incentive?
Well, normally it's like something that I like want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever feel like it's getting like too much a day, I always feel it's important to take a break.
Okay, yeah, take a break. We're talking with Emmanuel Govias and Maya Jadoff. They're co-champions of the Badger State Spelling Bee. Brad Williams is here, pronouncer for the Badger State Spelling Bee. You can join in with your questions. Maybe you got a word to stump these champions. 800-642-1234. Yeah, you know, give it a try. Brad, you know, tell us about the road to the Scripps National Spelling Bee and how that all works and comes together. Can you kind of give us that timeline?
Just about every school has classroom spelling bees during the year. And what happens with most of the students are right around the first part of the year, or maybe even earlier, they'll have the classroom bees, and usually the school will have an organized bee of its own that will determine who goes on to the next level. As I said, there are CESA programs around Wisconsin that have the regional spelling bees in the different CESA locations, Madison, La Crosse, and Milwaukee, and they choose certain students to go on to the Badger Bee, which usually has about 40 or 50 spellers in it each year. And this year, we have three spellers. There's a third speller who did not finish first, but is also a qualifier for the Nationals. And as I said earlier, they can get very many hundreds of spellers from around the country with sponsoring groups to qualify for the preliminaries. And this year, of course, they are going to narrow it down to about 10 students to actually go in person to Orlando for the finals.
Wow. So that's really going to just be difficult to get to Orlando if you've got all of these students from around the country and then narrowing it down to just a handful.
It is, it's easier, I guess, than we think, is that if they go through the written test, which is what we had to do here in the Badger Bee this year, it was a two-step process, which it normally isn't. Usually we would have the 40 or 50 students on stage in Madison. This year we had, on the Thursday before the finals, we had the 50 spellers take a written test, and the top qualifiers, the 10 from that who had the highest scores, went on to the finals that we did online on that Saturday.
Ah, all right. So trying to get a little more creative here in the pandemic. Maya, as we wrap up, can you share any advice for other kids who would like to practice their spelling? What would you suggest?
I would just say that if you study hard and have fun, then you should do pretty well.
All right. And Emmanuel, any tips you can share for other kids on spelling?
Yeah, just like Maya said, if you can work hard and, you know, enjoy the process, then you will be able to achieve like great things and have fun at the same time.
Well, Emmanuel and Maya, best of luck. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Brad, thank you for being here.
Everybody have fun. Good luck to our finalists who are going on to the Nationals, and happy spelling.
Happy spelling. Let's leave it at that. Brad Williams, pronouncer, Emmanuel Govius, and Maya Jadup, co-champions of the Badger State Spelling Bee. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen Nomadland or Promising Young Woman? What do you think of these films? Join in 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about another vaccine.
Decades before COVID-19, there was an epidemic story with a successful ending. During the 20th century, Americans pulled together to defeat the polio virus, putting their faith in scientists and public health guidelines. Writer Dean Robbins tells us more about how Wisconsin played a part in this heroic effort.
Between the 1910s and the 1950s, polio was the stuff of American nightmares. The disease paralyzed or killed hundreds of thousands, particularly children. In 1937, the city of Milwaukee ordered 15,000 kids to stay home from school to prevent infections. During other outbreaks, Kenosha and Janesville closed their beaches. In the La Crosse Tribune, Staff Loveland described contracting polio at age 5 and becoming a quadriplegic. When Lonnie Miller of Westby was stricken in 1952, a janitor wearing gloves came into his classroom, removed his desk, and burned it, along with his textbooks and pencils. That's how scared people were of spreading the virus.
This year, the enemy, poliomyelitis, struck with such impact and fury that it shook the entire nation.
In our day, the coronavirus sparked a culture war, with people arguing over masks and social distancing. By contrast, 20th century Americans formed a united front against polio. President Franklin Roosevelt encouraged ordinary citizens to donate their spare change to polio research through the March of Dimes. Millions answered the call, from scout troops to church groups. Waitresses donated their tips, and children competed to see who could collect the most donations during Halloween. Dimes poured into the White House. The campaign was a boon for scientists, particularly Dr. Jonas Salk. The passionate young virologist saw children in leg braces and iron lungs and vowed to relieve their suffering. In 1948, he began working on a polio vaccine that would create what he called freedom from fear. Salk made a breakthrough in 1952, and 2 years later, his vaccine was the subject of a national field trial. Once again, Americans joined together on a vast scale. 3 million people helped raise funds for the biggest medical test in history, representing a unique collaboration among scientists, doctors, and the public. Run by volunteers across 44 states, including Wisconsin, it planned inoculations for nearly 2 million elementary school children. The volunteer army was 300,000 strong, including doctors, nurses, and teachers. Kids got a series of 3 shots and a pin that proclaimed them polio pioneers. Paula Brown Sinclair remembers participating in Eau Claire and being hailed as a local hero. When researchers declared the vaccine a success on April 12, 1955, Americans showed their gratitude.
It's a day of triumph for 40-year-old Dr. Jonas E. Salk, developer of the vaccine.
Shopkeepers painted, "Thank you, Dr. Salk," on their windows. Composers wrote waltzes in his honor. Young Terry Doblin of Milwaukee sent Salk a letter calling him a small man with a big mind. Polio cases plummeted, and within 6 years, the disease had almost vanished in the United States. Decades later, in the Kenosha News, Charles Licht recalled his youthful participation in the national field trial. He marveled over what he and his fellow citizens had accomplished. "Being a polio pioneer was, perhaps, the most important thing I have done in my life," he said. "We and Jonas Salk eradicated polio."
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison and author of the children's picture book, Thank You, Dr. Salk. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we're making space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to the Academy Awards on Sunday the 25th. So next up, it's Nomadland, starring the one and only Frances McDormand.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am, I know.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom says that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
All right, morning movie critics, bring on your reviews, your Oscar predictions, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaching courses on film. Anna, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Well, yeah. good morning. And you'll have to maneuver us through the plot line here of Nomadland without spoilers. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so it follows our protagonist is Fern. Fern, played by Frances McDormand in this kind of really remarkable performance. And Fern is from the town of Empire, Nevada. And we learn at the start of the film that the zip code for Empire has essentially been decommissioned because the town has essentially been abandoned. It's a company town, and the town, I think it was home to a gypsum plant, and because of the Great Recession, there's no longer any need for this product that's used in, I think, kind of sheetrock, in the production of sheetrock. And so Fern's husband is also dead in the film. And so she has, you know, kind of, you know, no job, no husband. And the film just follows Fern as she sort of embarks on this, the title of the film, on this nomadic existence, as she traverses the country and takes these kinds of jobs, these temporary jobs. We see a lot of Amazon warehouses. She works at Amazon warehouses, but she takes on other sorts of jobs that are sort of transient positions. And, you know, along with Fern's journey, we get to see a lot of the American West. Mm. And that is particularly what is so beautiful about the film, is the cinematography, kind of the showing America.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, that is something that is particularly, I think, wanted right now, as we've all been confined to our homes, is this kind of getting to go along with Fern on her journey.
Yeah. You know, Condé Nast Traveler called it a love letter to America's wide open spaces. So certainly there is that, but there's also this tension, right? There's this romance associated with the nomad lifestyle, but the reality is it's not romantic at all. There's the poverty, the desperation. What do you make of that tension?
Well, I mean, that too is, you know, it's a window into low wage work. Mm. And the fact that, you know, it's really hard to make a living doing these kinds of jobs that are so difficult. You know, the kinds of jobs, you know, really there that so many of us have no appetite for, you know, cleaning bathrooms at truck stops, for example. And, you know, shows too, just how challenging these warehouse jobs can be, and how physically demanding they are. At one point, she's working at a sugar beet processing factory and, you know, shoveling in these sugar beets. It's just really intensively labor intensive, and it's a very you know, it's the kind of work that is so we obviously learned a lot more about this past year. But it's still work that is invisible to so many of us. And you know, she's just kind of, you'd think, you know, the conventional narrative is all those Amazon jobs pay so well that she could maybe possibly get ahead. But the reality is that she takes these jobs for a few months at a time, and is never truly able to find a foothold. And living in her van too.
So. The film largely features amateur actors, including Wanakee native Derek Endres, who plays himself, and he's a houseless migrant worker. He told the Cap Times he's living this existential existence. What does amateur actors bring to this film?
I think they really bring a kind of authenticity to their performances. Chloe Zhao, the director, she's done this before, where she's really put amateur actors at the center of her films, and there is a kind of just an authenticity that McDormand, clearly as the pro she is able to really bounce off those performances, I think, quite well, and they too, these amateur actors. You know, just are captured in such a revealing, intriguing way. And it's not just him. It's, you know, we have the Bob Wells, the person who is sort of the van life guru, and he plays himself. There are two women that are just referred to by their first names in the cast, Linda May and Swanky, that portray themselves. And there's just this really, you know, what we are watching when we watch Nomadland, I think, is a kind of an attempt to reveal the real America. Well, when you're using, you know, real people who are essentially portraying variations on themselves, it does lend a kind of, again, that same word I'm coming back to, authenticity to the film, for sure.
Do you think it's that authenticity that is causing it to become a Best Picture nomination? I mean, what is it that is really propelling Nomadland forward?
You know, I think it's a film very much of the moment right now. And there's just so, you know, there's so much right now relating to, you know, wanting to understand more about economic disparity in our country, and understanding, you know, the pandemic obviously has revealed all of this, disparity ultimately, and wanting to understand, you know, how do low wage workers get by? What are they doing? How are they making it in the world? Are they making it in the world? And I think that, coupled though too with just the glorious scenery, the on location filming in places like the Badlands,
North Dakota,
the desert. You know, there's always, I think, a fascination with the desert in this country. You know, it goes back right now. In fact, I'm teaching a course on the American Western, and I think there are elements in the film that are certainly that kind of appeal to our sensibilities about the American West and the Western, even though it's certainly not your conventional, you know, triumphant John Ford film at all. But it's still just, we take pleasure, I think, still in the beauty of the landscapes that Chloe Zhao has captured in this film.
Anna, Anna Thompson Hajek is a senior lecturer at UW Whitewater, teaches courses on film. This is pianist Ludovico Einaudi, his music featured in Nomadland. Which performances did you enjoy watching in Nomadland or Promising Young Woman? Who deserves an Oscar this year? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. By Muna from the Oscar-nominated Promising Young Woman. The song is Nihilist. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So these Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards. If you've seen Promising Young Woman, would you recommend it? It's nominated for 5 Oscars. We'll take Best Picture. What do you think of Nomadland? Join in 800-642-1234. We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, and she's our guide. Let's bring in Rana now in Rice Lake. Hi, Rana. What do you think of Nomadland?
Hi, good morning. When I first started watching it, I was a little confused. I wasn't quite sure what I was watching. And then as I stuck with it, it just became this beautiful flower that was just opening up right before me. And as I watched the movie and just stayed with it, there were so many parts I could identify. And one of them was, I believe she's in her trailer. And she pulls out an article of clothing, which I think is her husband's or someone's. And she just has this moment of, for me, it seemed to be wanting the old life back and being sorrowful for not having that life currently. And I really related to that. It just made the movie so current for me and just so real that I ended up just ranting and raving about it and loving it in the end. So thank you. That's really all I had.
Thank you, Rana. So it really blossomed and there's some of that yearning in it, Anna.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, our caller, you know, discussed here the relatability of that narrative. And I think, you know, that I think is so revealing that, you know, this past year has been, you know, very traumatic for so many Americans. And this particular narrative is dealing more with the fallout of the Great Recession of 2008, 2007, 2008. And so I think, but you know, that it's still, again, as it is this movie of the moment that so many people can connect with because of the grief, the loss that Fern is feeling and how she's sort of dealing with that grief and loss is how we learn more about her throughout the journey of the film.
Well, let's switch gears here and go to the next film, Promising Young Woman. Can you give us a plot line here?
So this follows also kind of a story of grief and loss in a very different light. And this is the story of Cassie. And we learn kind of early on about Cassie that she is somebody that has experienced a trauma in her past, and it's ultimately a friend of hers, and she was once in medical school with her friend, and the friend is a childhood friend, and they, her friend has ultimately, and I guess I'll just say here, spoiler alert, it's hard to explain explain a lot of this film without giving away some spoilers.
Yeah,
but her friend was sexually assaulted in medical school. Her friend subsequently commits suicide, and Cassie is sort of haunted by this. And her method of dealing with this trauma is to, once or twice a week, go out and seduce men and pretend to be under the influence and get these men to take her home. And then, you know, when she is, you know, kind of gets right to that point where these men seem like they're going to step over the boundary, she immediately becomes sober and kind of calls out these men for their behavior.
How does, Well, how does the film take on rape culture and the kind of the grim consequences of rape culture?
Well, I think it does so in a very dark way, ultimately. And, you know, there's a number of commentators that have said that this is a kind of almost a therapeutic action for Cassie, that she does this over and over again. And I think, you know, it's a black comedy. Cassie in the end seems to have the last laugh. But there's a lot of really dark things that happen throughout the film in terms of her ability to convey a kind of social justice meted out. And I think it leaves the viewer wondering, is it enough? Is the way that this film is resolved? Is it enough? Is it dealt with in a way that brings a kind of closure? And I'm not really sure if I have the answer to that, but I think the film uses comedy. It uses some tropes that we're familiar with, like for a good portion of the film, we think we're sort of watching a kind of romantic comedy, in a way, but it is not ultimately. It is a revenge story. It is a story of revenge. It's a story, I think, in some respects, shares some overlap with a movie like the Kill Bill films. And so, if you are a fan of those kinds of films, there are elements to Promising Young Woman that may appeal to you. But it is certainly a movie about sexual trauma, and it's a movie that is difficult to handle in some respects. So if that is something that you are disturbed by more broadly, I probably wouldn't recommend it. But I think that the director, and I believe the writer, Emerald Fennell, is doing something different here. Yeah. And that, I think that's why she's the film has been recognized. It puts a spin on a film, on a kind of narrative that is so often women don't get that justice that they deserved, or so often they are, you know, saved by the man in the end. You know, that doesn't happen. There's no princess being whisked away in the end, at the end of this film. It's a film that is rather bleak, but it is a movie that is, I think, too, that the main character, Cassie, is doing things on her own terms.
But what I really want to get out of you and ask you about this film, does it romanticize the notion of girl power? Does it get girl power wrong?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I think I don't think it romanticizes girl power in the end because of the way the film ultimately does end. But it I don't know about that. But I do think that it the movie is a little bit too tidy in its resolution too. Okay, so this is the big spoiler. So if you do want to see this film, I feel like I can't talk about it without.
But please come back to the morning show. All right, carry on.
Right, is that our protagonist Cassie? She does lose her life in the end, and it's a very violent conclusion to this, to kind of what her character arc is. And there's still a kind of she still sort of provides closure through some things that she's able to do and set up before the movie ends. And so that part of it I felt was just a little bit too tidy and neat in the end, because she put ultimately, I feel like, too much faith in the criminal justice system.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It was good. Thank you so much.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer, UW-Whitewater. Come back next week for more Oscar Buzz. Every Friday in April, Anna drops by to discuss two of the Best Picture nominees. Next up, Minari and Sound of Metal. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.